Sunday meeting. Hi, my name is Misty and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
guys. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, and I must have this thing. Now, I get to introduce tonight's speaker. I met her when I first came in the rooms in Noonan in 21. I'm really excited to hear her story, and I'm going to give to you guys Mary Ann.
I'm Mary Ann, and I'm an alcoholic. I'll be really nervous for like 10 minutes, and then I'll get okay, but I'm going to just go ahead and tell you I'll be nervous. Plus, y'all are all over the room, so I can't. My vision is all over the place. Let's see, my sobriety date is August 24th, 2010, and I'm coming up on 13 years. And I did meet Misty in 21. It was really interesting. I was in a dry drunk when I met Misty. I had some life on life's terms had happened to me, and they had asked me to speak in Griffin, and I told them they didn't want me to speak because I was in a dry drunk, and I'll talk a little bit about what that is, but they wanted me to speak anyway, and Misty went with me. Where'd she go? Okay. Thank you. So I come from a long line of alcoholics and criminals. I didn't used to say that, but I have another friend, her name's Kelly, and she's in AA, and so she wants to make sure that y'all don't think I'm normal, or that I grew up normal. And so I didn't grow up normal. I come from a long line of alcoholics. Everybody in my family is alcoholic, except for my mother, and she was crazy. So the alcoholics were the same one in my family. And so I don't think anybody ever grows up and says, I want to be an alcoholic. But I grew up and said, I'm not going to be an alcoholic, because I knew that there were a lot of alcoholics in my family, and they caused my mom a lot of grief, and they caused a bunch of stuff all the time. So I truly was not going to be an alcoholic. I thought that alcoholics were weak, and that that's why they couldn't, you know, stop drinking, and they just caused a lot of problems, because that's what happened in my family, who knew I was already an alcoholic, really. By the time I was thinking that, I was already judging and an alcoholic. Let's see. I was an alcoholic from the beginning, but I had no idea. Like, the first time I ever drank, I was 14, and my friend's parents had went to Italy, and they worked for Delta, and they had a bottle of wine. And my other two friends just took a sip of it and tasted it, and I turned the whole bottle up and drank it and got drunk, and then, you know, caused a bunch of problems later. And that is my drinking career. That's what that was the whole drinking career. Drink a bunch of wine, drink a bunch of whatever, get drunk, cause a bunch of shit, and, you know, have to clean it up. But I did that at 14. At 16, I was leaving a game room. My parents were at a Christmas party in Atlanta. I live in Noonan, about 30 miles south of here. And there was only one place in town that I wasn't allowed to go to, and that was Tom's Game Room. So before they ever hit the interstate, I headed straight for Tom's Game Room. And I was drinking MD 2020 and Sprite that night. And when I left, it was pouring down rain, and I was putting on lipstick in the mirror in the rain. Well, when I looked up from putting my lipstick on, there was a parked Cadillac sitting right there. So I crossed the center line and hit a parked Cadillac head on, and totaled my car and the parked Cadillac. And I had a friend with me, And she started crying, and I got pissed off because I said, you better stop crying right now because the police are going to be here and you're going to get me in trouble, you know. I mean, she was probably, you know, hurt, you know what I'm saying? I just could have kind of like head on. I don't like for people to cry. I'm that crazy with the police to come around. I like everybody to be calm. One of the first things that I'm going to tell y'all something. The first thing that I ever heard in an AA meeting that I related to, this is the best thing I've ever heard. When I tell y'all this, y'all are going to know exactly what he was talking about. I was in an AA meeting. I was not thinking I was an alcoholic. I was not relating to you all, nothing. But there was a guy, and his name was Rudy. And Rudy, this is what Rudy said. He said, let's see, did he say? He said kids are like cops. It's not that I don't like them. It's just that I'm more comfortable when they're not around. And that was the first thing that I ever related to in AA. And if I have a cop in here, I respect the police officers greatly. I really do. Now, not this. But that was back in the early 80s. I'm 56, so I was 16 then. So that was in the early 80s, and the police came and threw my MD-2020 in the bushes and took me to the hospital. That doesn't happen today, you know what I'm saying? But that was a long time ago. So I always had a problem with drinking. I can remember drinking that bottle of 20. I was drinking the MD-2020 and chasing it with Sprite, and I just remember drinking it as hard and fast as I could. And I had no idea why. No, I'd never seen anybody do that. Nobody had ever told me to do that. I was young, and that's just the way I drank. I graduated from high school. I moved to Atlanta. I got a job in a bar. I got a boyfriend that was a drug dealer. That was really fun. And so the thing about me is it really doesn't matter if it's a drug dealer or a real estate office or whatever. I always think I can do whatever it is that somebody else is doing. You know what I'm saying? So I really got into the drug business. And so I did that for about 6 years. And the reason I got out of it is because, I mean, I wish I could say because it was like a really bad thing and you shouldn't do that and it ruins people's lives, but that's not why I got out of it. I got out of it because my friends were dying and going to federal prison. I could handle prison, but the federal prison was getting me because those sentences are, you know, you get 18 years, you're doing 17. And I didn't want the police to come take all my stuff. That's why I, you know, decided to stop selling drugs. And so I got rid of the drug dealer boyfriend, not because I wanted to. I really worshiped the ground that he walked on. But he lost his father, and then he went off the deep end into addiction. And I couldn't do it. So I'm not going to say I flew right for a few years, but, you know, I got married, I had a kid, I worked a job. Now, if I got drunk, it's still, you know, I just didn't get drunk all the time. But if I got drunk, you know, I couldn't just drink a little bit. So I would end up, you know, driving drunk. I didn't get a DUI. I've never had a DUI. I don't know why I have to knock on wood. I don't even drink anymore. I never had a DUI. But, you know, like I have a big front yard, and for those of you that know my front yard, like I walk out in the morning and my car's like in the middle of my front yard instead of over in the driveway. I have no idea why it's like that. And so I called it partying. I like to party. And then I'm going to talk a little bit, I hope I don't offend anybody, old timers out there. I'm going to talk a little bit about drugs because I did not think I was an alcoholic. And this is the other thing about me. I can control my drugs better than I control my alcohol. You know, when I start drinking, I can't stop. You know what I'm saying? If I start drinking, I might do 40 shots. I might do 40 drinks. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, when you do acid, I've never done 40 hits of acid. And so in my mind, I mean, it's not even in my mind. I could control drugs better than I could my alcohol. I could not control alcohol. So So I always, you know, I didn't drink every day. I mean, I did by the time I got here, but like in this part of the story, I didn't drink every day. But when I drank, I got really, really, really wasted. So I'm out of the drug business. I'm trying to fly ride. I think I'm doing okay. I'm an alcoholic. I have no idea I'm an alcoholic. But in 1 year, my favorite aunt died in May. My sister, who was 57, died in June. My mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and my dad was diagnosed with colon cancer in November. And I had a little one, like a probably about a five-year-old. She was born in 2000. It's not that hard. I had a five-year-old. It was really, really hard. And I had Xanax for my nerves, you know. And so I started, I mean, I always took them. Like, I don't want to act like I just started taking them, because I didn't just start taking them, but I probably started abusing them at that time. I liked them. I took them for everything. I liked them. They made me sleepy. They made me awake. They made me focused. They made me happy. And I thought that I only drank, because I've also drank, I thought that I only drank to make my Xanax last longer throughout the month. That's what I thought. So, I'm not a real big, I know this sounds mean, I don't mean to sound mean. I'm not that lady that like sees a baby and goes, oh my God, they're so cute. And, you know, I'm just not really like a baby kid person. I have a kid and she's really cool. But not when she was a baby. And the reason I'm telling you this is because I'm in the height of my addiction. I'm drinking, I'm taking pills. I remember waking up and on my couch one day, and I mean, this was like a real thought. So I wake up on my couch and I'm totally dressed in what I had on. I haven't moved. Like, I went to the kitchen, I got a bottle of wine, I got a bottle of pills, I sat there, and I just fell asleep sitting up. And I guess I slept that way all night. And I woke up the next day and I'm like, I still got the same, like, nothing's wrinkled. Like, I've just been sitting there all night. And I was like, man, I wish this would be cool if I could just go to work in the same clothes, you know what I'm saying? Because no one would ever, you know, it would just be really cool, which was, you know, probably a sign. So I don't really like kids. So since I didn't really like kids, I married a man that had three. And this was my boyfriend from a long time ago. We dated back when I was like 19 or 20, and he had three kids. They were like 18, 17, 14, I think, at the time. And I am batshit crazy in my addiction, and I don't even know it. I have no idea. Like, people say I knew I was an alcoholic, I knew I was doing this. I didn't know anything. I thought all these people in my life and my family were causing me problems, and if you had my life and my family, you would drink and take pills too. And that I was doing a pretty damn good job. Is what I thought, which was not true, but I didn't know it. I was completely delusional. So I married this guy that's got three kids. I don't love kids. Now I got all these damn kids, right? Plus I already had one. And so I decided, because if this was a parenting scale, I'm over here and he's over here, right? And so I decided that we need marriage counseling. And so I tell him, which, by the way, we got married in May and I went to rehab in August. So I tell him that I want to we need to go to marriage counseling because I don't know what my place is in this family. Well, that was a lie. I wanted him to go to marriage counseling. I thought that the counselor was going to tell him that he was right. No, he was wrong and I was right and we'd get this stuff straightened out, right? But that's not what happened. She asked me to come back by myself, which I did. I thought she was probably going to tell me that I probably just need to go ahead and get rid of him. We could just, you know, it was a lost cause. And she asked me about my drinking, and I shared about my drinking. And she asked me about, I guess she asked me about Xanax. I don't know. Robert Downey Jr., I saw him on Oprah one time, and he said, if you're lying about what you're using, then you probably have a problem. So I thought that the answer was don't lie about what you're using. Do you see what I'm saying? So when she asked me, I told her, and she looked at me and said, you need to go check yourself into rehab. You're going to die. And I was like, I'm sorry, did you not hear what I said? You know, I told you that I had all these kids, and I've got a house, and I'm selling real estate, and I'm taking care of my dad, and he's 80, and I can't go to rehab. And I thought it was very dramatic that she said I was going to die. And it pissed me off, and I told her that I would just stop that weekend. It was a Wednesday, and that I would just stop that weekend. And she told me a bunch of bullshit, like your disease is going to talk to you, and there's no reason to white knuckle it, and you're going to, you know, all this stuff. And I was like, I really didn't like it. I didn't like her. But the funny thing is, I said, it was a Wednesday, and I said, I don't have a problem with alcohol. So I'm just going to go ahead and tell you that right now. So I'm going to go ahead and stop the alcohol. Like, I don't need another drink, but I'm not going to stop. I'll stop taking my pills on Friday night. After, because I sold advertising for Auto Trader, and I had to turn all my stuff in, you know, and so I said, I'll do that. It's very stressful, especially when you're on pills and alcohol. And so I said, I'll wait till after that. And she didn't think that was a good idea, and I didn't care. So I hadn't had any alcohol since Wednesday, and I hadn't had any Xanax since 6 o'clock on Friday night. By Saturday at 12 o'clock, I was in full withdrawals, and I was coming unglued. I was coming out of my skin, and all the things that she told me that was going to happen was happening to me. She told me my disease was going to talk to me, so I ran over to my dad's because I knew there was a six-pack of Bud Light over there, Bud Light Lime, and so I ran over and got that. And I started drinking those as fast as I could get them down, and I started throwing pills in my mouth as fast as I could get them because I just needed to get okay, and I couldn't get okay. Like, I was messed up. And so, finally, after about 9 Xanax and 6 beers in 4 minutes, I started getting okay. And so, this is what my disease, I didn't know it was my disease, but this is what my disease said. They asked me not to cuss in the email. Hang on. Screw that. I'm not doing that shit again. I'm not going to not drink, and I'm not going to not take pills. So I went back the next week, and I told her what I did, and she wanted me to check myself into rehab, and I said, I'm not going to do that. I went back the next week. She said, we want you to check yourself into rehab. And I said, I'm not going to do that. And she said, well, I want to share something with you. She said, you have a tolerance to alcohol and Xanax, but your respiratory system does not. And you're not going, one day you're just not going to wake up. And your little girl's going to wake up next to you dead. And that got my attention a little bit. Okay, because really, remember, she's really dramatic, this counselor is, and I knew that. And so she asked me if I would go to Ridgeview and take an assessment, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'll do that. I like assessments. And so I can do that. I wasn't going to go check myself in, but I'll go take an assessment. So I go up there, they give me an assessment. They tell me I'm going to die, same stuff. I thought that the lady called up there and told them to tell me that I was going to die. And so I'm like, oh, my God. So I was like, no. They said, we have a bed for you right now, and you need to check in right now. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. And so I was going home, and I was going down 285, and I had this moment of clarity, and I thought, what if that lady didn't tell them to tell me I was going to die? What if they really think I'm going to die? And I called, I have a friend, one of my best friends, and she's not an alcoholic. She doesn't need Al-Anon. She's completely healthy, and it pisses me off. She thinks about what she says before she says it. She always has. And I called her, and I said, hey, I'm coming back from Ridgeview, and this is what they said. Do you think I need to check myself into rehab? And she goes, yes, you do now. And so I said, normally she thought about what she said. So I checked myself into rehab. And It was not what I expected. There was a one-armed man in a dress, I think. I'm not sure. I mean, when I look back on it now, I've been sober for a long time. I'm pretty sure there was a one-armed man in a dress that kept walking by, but maybe there wasn't. I mean, I've really tried to think, was he really there? I mean, he was really there in my mind. And they put me in this place where they were watching me, and I didn't. They had this big guy. He was like 6'5", and he was from Harlem. And you could tell his nose had been broke. And he was staring at me. And I asked him, "What are you staring at? What is your problem?" And I didn't know then, but I know now that was his job, was to watch watch the crazy people and make sure that they, were safe. And so when I left rehab, I went to him, and this is the first time anybody ever said this to me. I know y'all have heard this too. I apologized to him for, I was really ugly. They told me not to cuss, so I'm not going to tell you what I said. But this is what he said to me. "It's okay, honey. You kept me sober this weekend." And I didn't know what that meant. I thought, cool. I didn't know that meant, "You are so batshit crazy that you kept me sober. Like, you make me not want to drink." And I couldn't read or write. Like, it really messed me up. Like, I could not read or write. I had been doing that for 10 years. I'd been doing pills and alcohol for 10 years, and I could not read or write. And my job required me at the time to read and to write. So I went into their day program, not because I thought I needed it, because I couldn't read or write. And I was afraid that if I went back to my job and said I can't read or write, that they would fire me. And so that's why I went to the day program. And all they did is send me to AA, you know what I'm saying? And every night they would say, you were supposed to go to AA, and you were supposed to get a sponsor, and you were supposed to do all these things. And so I would try to do that. And I went to a meeting at the clubhouse, and my sister-in-law took me, and I was in withdrawals. I was having issues with lights, and everything looked really dirty to me everywhere I went. And if you, like, picked up a drink, like if you were sitting next to me and you picked up a drink like that, it looked like it was coming at me. So you might, like, pick up a drink and I might, like, jump back. I mean, I was really messed up. I mean, I was sober, but I was messed up. And so I went to this meeting. It was at the clubhouse in Noonan. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it was dirty. It really was dirty. It was an old, it was an old building, and it was dirty, and the lights were bad, and it was really bad. And I went to that meeting, and the lady that was next to me, she did everything but get up on the table and do jumping jacks. I mean, I was just coming out of my skin. So I said, okay, I'm going to go over to Peachtree City tomorrow night. There's got to be a better class of drunks over there, you know. And so that's why I went to Peachtree City, and there was this lady, and when I stumbled in because I couldn't even walk straight, she pulled out a chair and asked me if I wanted to sit down. And that was my sponsor. I think for the first 5 years of my sobriety, she ended up passing away with brain cancer. And she pulled out a seat and asked me if I wanted to sit down. And my sponsor was really tough. I mean, everybody doesn't have a tough sponsor or need a tough sponsor, but my sponsor was tough. And I needed a tough sponsor because I have a real strong personality. And if you give me the opportunity, I will run over you. Or I will talk you into doing it my way or something. You know what I'm saying? And I was not going to do this with this woman. She cared much more about me not dying than she did, how I felt. And I was a pain in the ass. Like, I wanted to, I mean, I was a pain in the ass. I didn't know I was a pain in the ass until I was about 5 years sober. And a man named John P., who I adored, I was taking him to the VA here in Atlanta, and this is what he said to me. He goes, "You were lucky to get Karen as your sponsor because you were a problem when you first got here." And I was not aware that I was the problem. So she took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was really mean, and she told me that she was not my, that she was going to take me through these, you know, 12 steps, that she had some ground rules, and they were not to lie to her, not to lie to her, and not to drink before I called her. She told me that she wasn't my mother, and she wasn't going to be my friend, and I thought, well, I didn't say it because I was scared of her, but I thought, I already have a mother, and I don't need any more friends, but thanks. And she said, she was a retired school teacher, and I was a retired drug dealer, and I didn't know how that was going to work, but she was an alcoholic that had been through the 12 steps, and so she said, we're going to meet once a week. She said, you're going to call me every day. You're going to call me every day at 8 a.m. That's what she said. You're going to call me every day at 8 a.m. And I was like, okay. And she said, we're going to meet once a week, and we're going to go through this book, and we're going to read it line by line. And when we get to a prayer, we're going to pray it. And when we get to a step, we're going to step it. And I was like, okay. I didn't know she meant we were literally going to read every freaking sentence in here and go over it, but that's what she meant, you know. And so, you know, she took me through this book, and, you know, I would get mad because other people would get to go through the steps, because she wasn't big on explaining shit to me, okay? She just suggested what she wanted me to do, and I could either do it or not, but she wasn't going to explain to me why I needed it. And I looked at those steps, and I went, step one, not to her, but she knew I was doing this. So step one, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Okay. A, I'm not powerless over alcohol, and B, my life is not manageable. Then I said, step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. If I was insane, I'm sure God could do that, but I'm not. And three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I believed in God, so I thought I was already doing that. In fact, I told my sponsor I was already doing that. And I already believed in God. So when we got to We Agnostics, I asked her if we could skip that chapter because I wasn't agnostic. And she said, no, I'm going to make you read it twice. So I was ready to start my fourth step. I haven't done the first, second, and third step. Now, I haven't told her that, but she knows it. You know what I'm saying? She can tell by the way I'm acting. I'm 6 months in, and I go down to Sonoy for a meeting, and I announce to everybody that I really, really like them. And, I mean, I really like everybody there. Really, really like y'all. But I am not an alcoholic. And, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go do some controlled drinking, because I don't know if y'all know that, but it says in the big book, if you don't know, then go do some controlled drinking. And so I shared this at a meeting, and one of the men, Matt, who's really, really nice and never says anything smart, I mean, even to this day, he said, when it got around to him, he said, you know, we can't tell you if you're an alcoholic or not, but if you've been in a locked psychiatric unit, you might have a problem with alcohol. And which I just figured he was wrong. And the bar was real close to the AA meeting, so I was sitting in my car at my parking lot. But remember, she told me I had to call her before I drank, okay? So I called her, and I said, hey, I appreciate everything you've done. I'm decided I'm not an alcoholic, and just to prove it, I'm going to go over here to McGuire's, and I'm going to get one glass of wine, and I'm going to drink it, and I'm going to go home. And she said, okay. She said, let me just share couple things with you. And I said, okay. She said, first of all, people that aren't alcoholics don't get big gulps of malt liquor and drink those as they're working all day, because that's what I did. Because I thought that if it was like strawberry malt liquor or grape or whatever, that you couldn't smell the alcohol. I know, stupid. At least it wasn't vodka. That's what everybody else says. But she said, people that don't have a problem with alcohol don't drink malt liquor all day while they're working. And I was like, okay, I could get that. She said, the other thing is, people that don't have a problem with alcohol, they don't have to go to the bar and order a glass of wine and see if they can drink it and then leave. They just don't drink. And I was like, oh. And it was that night that I got serious and started doing what she asked me to do. So around that same time, it would have been December, and right after Christmas, she had me come over. It was 2010, and this is the question she asked me. What are you going to do differently about your sobriety in 2011? I was so offended. I did say it this time. I said, what do you mean? Because I had been working my ass off to stay sober. You know what I mean? And she said, well, if this is what you've got, then you're going to need, if you're not going to do anything differently about your sobriety, then you're going to need to find a new sponsor. And I did not like that. But I got my shit together and I started doing. She asked me the same thing at the end of 2011 again. And I thought I had been working really hard, you know what I mean? And she never had to ask me that after that, but she did ask me that two years in a row. I finally got to do the fourth step after doing the first, second, and third step. When I tell you I didn't know anything was wrong with me and that I did not know that I was a problem, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I had 39 resentments for my husband. 39 for my husband. I felt like she tricked me. She told me to write down everything that pissed me off. I wrote down everything that pissed me off, and then she turned all that shit around on me at the end. She had to help me. I thought I had parts and stuff that I didn't have parts in, and then I had tons of parts and things that I had no clue. And it really kind of freaks me out. Like, some people are like, oh, I did the fifth step. I feel like the world is lifted off my shoulders. That's not how I felt. I felt like I couldn't even talk for about 2 weeks. Like, I had been thinking all this time that it was everybody else, and she was able to show me that it was me, so I couldn't even trust myself. Like, I really did not think it was me. And now I can clearly see on this paper that it's me. So I didn't talk for about 2 weeks. Like, I just didn't know what to do. She also did things like, she was real big on service. And she told me to get a service position, and I was thinking about what would be good service for me. You know, what would work for me? And then while I was thinking about what would work for me, she went and signed me up, you know, for service. She did that till the day she passed. She would just not listen. She signed me up for the AA hotline. That just about did me in. she signed me up for, you know, prepaid conventions. She signed me up for a district position. I can't remember what that one was. She just signed, whatever anybody said, she was like, yeah, Marianne will do that. I got, because she gave me the opportunity to do it myself, and I didn't do it. But I stayed sober. I stayed sober, and she wasn't afraid to tell me, you know, oh my gosh, I have to tell y'all about, I'm going through the steps is what I'm doing. So step one, I told you how I did that. The fourth and fifth, step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all those defects of character. I did not do that. I didn't do much right. What I did do right is I didn't drink, and I showed up for meetings, and I did my service work. But I just missed that somehow. So I set out to remove my own character defects. I went around trying to be nice. That's what I thought. That's what I thought that meant. Like, I would just go around and try to be nice, and I wasn't nice. And even when I was trying to be nice, I didn't know how to be nice. And so, you know, I had to back up on those steps. It took me forever. It does not say for you to remove your own character defects. It says that you be willing and that you ask God to do it. And it took me a long time to do that. And then I'm in early sobriety. And I told a lie. I will tell a lie. I'm going to tell y'all I will tell a lie. I try not to tell lies now. I have had to make a couple of amends for lying in sobriety, because I will lie if it will make something easier for me. I will do that. I have done that. I haven't done in a minute because of the last amends I had to make. But I had told a lie to this real estate agent. It was a stupid lie. It was just to make something easier for me. I'm barely sober. And she makes me call that real estate agent and make an amends to that real estate agent for lying. And I was like, I can't do that. I'm a real estate agent. Like, everybody's going to talk about me. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're going to kick me out of the real estate world in Noonan, Georgia. And She made me write it down. She always made me write my amends down. She said I used too many words. And because what happens is with me with too many words, if I'm doing an amends, what those words lead to is why you made me do whatever it is that I'm trying to make an amends for. So I had to keep my amends. They had to go on an index card. And so I forgot my big book. I forgot my big book because I came from work, and I had that card in there, that first one that I ever did, and I really miss my big book today. But she made me write it out, and then, like, there would be a sentence, and then it would say pause, and then I'd have to be quiet and let the, you know, the other lady speak, which the other lady was like, okay, you know, okay. It was really weird. Oh, and I told my sponsor, yes, I will get to that. And she said, get out your phone. You're going to do it now. So that was like, I was barely freaking sober when I had to do that. But let me tell you what, I didn't tell a lie for a minute after that, because that's when I realized that she was serious about working these, you know, 12 steps in and out of your life. Now, I also told a lie a couple years ago. This was a different sponsor, and this was also a stupid lie. So I am talking to one of my clients, and I don't want to talk anymore. And so I'm ready to get off the phone because I've just pulled up at Dillard's, okay? And so instead of saying I just pulled up at Dillard's, I tell her, I go, okay, well, I just pulled up at my walkthrough, so I'll talk to you later. I go in Dillard's. I already knew what I was getting. I go in there. I get a pair of shoes. I come right back out. And that was, like, during COVID. So I don't know if anybody went to Bath and Body Works, but they would only let, like, a few people in at a time. So the people, they'd have them lined up down the sidewalk. Who do you think was standing in the Bath and Body Works line? The lady that I had just lied to. So let me tell you. So she's standing there. She sees me. I see her. So this is my solution. I'm 10 years sober, by the way. 10 years sober. So I am thinking about what I am going to go over there and tell her. I'm going to tell her another lie. That's what I'm thinking. But thank God, she, about that time, I guess they let her go in, right? So I call my sponsor because I know what I got to do, right? And she says, you know what you got to do. And I'm like, man, you're kidding me. Because sometimes she'll just let me off for stuff. I mean, really, sometimes the sponsor will let you off. But she said no. Because remember about a couple months ago when you said blah, 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 another lie. And so I actually went to this lady's home and made the amends. And I told them, you know, what I did. And they, it was a husband and wife. They're my clients. I'm listing their house in a couple of days. But the husband's probably one of us, only he's not in recovery. But anyway, they busted out laughing. And they said the reason we're laughing is because we do that, you know, we do that all the time. But they said that. And then, like, they sent me a text one time because they needed me to do something. They said, where are you? And I said, I'm at the office. And they said, are you really at the office? Or are you here? And they sent a picture of Dillard's. I really try hard not to lie anymore. I'm not saying I'll never lie again, but yeah. So I came out of that fog of it's not them, it's me, right? And I made my direct amends. I do continue to take personal inventory. I do seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, and I do try to practice this in all my affairs. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. My sponsees sponsor people. I have friends like I've never, you know, I've never had before. I think I've got about 5 minutes, so I'm going to tell my dry drunk story. So AA has brought me everything that I have. I mean, I really love AA. The difference between when I first got sober and when I'm sober now is I'm happy that I'm sober. I want to be sober. I didn't want to be sober, you know, when I first got sober. I remember telling my sponsor, how am I not going to drink when my daughter gets married? And she said, isn't your daughter 8? And I said, she is, but I was worried about that. And the funny thing about that is that my daughter got married on May the 5th. in an all-inclusive resort where there was just alcohol everywhere, and I didn't even think about having a drink. Not at all. So that's a trip. And, you know, this disease is real. It's changed my life, and most of the time I'm happy, joyous, and free. As long as I'm not running my own life, it says in How It Works. I missed this for about 5 years. It says in How It Works. Is it up here? Right before the ABCs, it said, this is, I think I'm going to paraphrase, this is our experience before and after, meaning before you got sober and, or before I got sober and after I got sober. A, I can't manage my own life. Before I got sober, I couldn't manage my own life. After I got sober, I can't manage my own life. And I proved that about the time that I had met Misty, my daughter's boyfriend, overdosed on heroin. He didn't die the first time, and he was like my child. And so I'd had 5 years of Al-Anon and 10 years of AA, and every freaking bit of that went straight out the window, and I set out to get him sober. Well, let me tell you what happened. I got really, really sick, and he died. That's what happened. That's what happens. We cannot get people sober. I started taking him to meetings. I stopped listening. I was listening, but I was listening so that I could hear what I needed to repeat back to him to make sure that he heard that during the meeting. And I begged God. I begged God. I begged him to save him. To not let him die. And he died. On his grandmother's couch of a heroin overdose. And I think everybody else expected it, because everybody could see it coming except for me, and it just about killed me, and I got mad at God. I mean, I got really mad at God. And so, I don't know if y'all feel like this, but when I'm in an AA meeting, I feel like I'm in God's living room. Like, I can feel that, okay? Well, if I'm mad at Misty, I'm not going to go sit in her living room. So, I didn't want to go sit in God's living room. I didn't want to go. And my home group is Turin. And in Turin is where he lived. His grandmother lived here. His mother lived here. And his house was here. So, I couldn't even get to my meeting without going by one of those houses. And I was in a lot of pain because I didn't think God should have done that. And I know God didn't do it. But I got really mad. And so, my sponsor didn't really care how I always have these mean sponsors. I'm serious. And she didn't give a damn. And at first she was trying to make me go to my home group. And then she said, I don't give a damn where you go, just get to a meeting. So I was going to about one meeting a week, which is not enough for me. I was going to, it might be enough for some people, but it is not enough for me. So I was going to one meeting a week. And I didn't want to go to my home group, and it just about killed me. So this went on for about 60 days. Now, I am sober, okay? When I came in here the first time, I was in an alcoholic fog and in withdrawals, and that was tough. But being on a dry drunk for me was tougher because I was a clear mind, and I was freaking miserable. In 60 days, I had just about burned my life down again. I hadn't drank. I was getting a divorce. I hated everybody in my family. I was freaking miserable because I quit. I mean, I didn't make the conscious thing to say I'm not going to trust and rely on God. I was just mad at him. So if I'm mad at you, I'm not going to talk to you. And if I'm not talking to you, then I'm not checking with you on how I should be running my life. So sober, that 60 days, I just about burned my life to the ground. So, my sponsor made me pick up my chip in my home group, and it really felt like, you know, sad. You know what I'm saying? Like, it made me feel better. So I love this program, and but I've done it both ways. I've done it the hard way, and I've done it the easy way, and I'm telling you, you do not want to do a dry drunk. I mean, I feel like I'm justified in my dry drunk. I know that's a terrible word, justified anger, justified whatever, but I felt like I was justified. And regardless if I was justified or not, I was the one that was miserable. But I'm not miserable today. I'm not. And that's me. if I don't do these 12 steps and work this program, that's going to be me. I buried, I mean, I didn't bury her, but we had another friend, and it's on Wednesday. So this disease is really real, people. Like, it's really real. I did not know that. I did not know that people died of alcoholism. I knew people died of drug overdoses, but I didn't know you could die of alcoholism, but you can. And so I'm really grateful for all the people that prayed for me when I couldn't pray for myself. And it says in the 12 and 12 that there'll come a day when you can't pray. And it just says, just pick it back up when you can. And so that's what I did. And I'm really glad to be alive. And I'm really glad that somebody told me that, you know, I couldn't keep doing that and that I believed them. Just keep coming back. It does get easier, unless you're bullheaded like me, and then it could get harder. But then if you get with the program, it'll get easier again. So that's all I have. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Marianne. That was beautiful. Thank you.
I used to hate my pain, avoid the feelings like a winter rain. I'd run away, hiding the hurt with a drink or an angry word, until the day I could not deny the healing calling from deep inside. It was a love that was here to mend my broken heart. Could be my friend. On the other side, I will rise above a mountain here to climb. As I grow, I stumble and I fall, but I am grateful for it all. On the other side, there is peace beneath the pain. A tender tear that I can't explain, washing away the fearful wounds, bearing a light for my life to bloom. On the other side, I will rise above a mountain I must climb. As I grow, I stumble and I fall, I am grateful for it all. On the other side, on the other side, I live my dreams, finding joy, freeing me. On the other side, I will rise above a mountain, I will climb. And as I grow, I stumble and I fall, but I am grateful for it all. On the other side, on the other side, ooh, on the other side.